Lectionary Lab Live is recorded by Two Bubbas and a Bible live from Gainesville, Florida and Brasstown, North Carolina. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Man, good to hear you. Today, we're going to talk a little text. Think about preaching for the 19th Sunday after Pentecost. These are the texts for September the 30th, 2018. We're just sneaking in one more Sunday here in what we usually think of as a short month. Time is passing on, and boy, oh boy, do we have some text today. On the one hand, no shortage of stuff to talk about. On the other hand, this is a Sunday it behooves a preacher to think right well about
carefully.
Which one of these you're going to talk about. Tell us what you got on your mind today, Bubba.
Well, I was only half facetiously thinking that you probably ought to preach on Numbers because that gospel text is just weird. I mean, woo! It's always been one, and I'll come back to it in a little bit, but
we shall not ignore the gospel reading today, but
cutting off your hand, cutting off your foot, tearing out your eye. You know, this is not, you know, not your normal good feeling gospel lesson. So, there are reasons why it's a little difficult. It's difficult to preach on because it doesn't have a lot of internal consistency, except you have to figure it out. And I'll come to that when I come back to the gospel. What I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, Brother John,
amen,
walk through Numbers a little bit and talk about this story. It's a great story, and it divides out into kind of four sections, any one of which could provide a good sermonic hook. So what I'm going to suggest is I'm going to walk through this story, breaking it into four sections, talking about each section, and then talking about ways in which one could preach it. And then we'll talk about the gospel a little bit. Does that work
for
you?
Well, I am fine with that. I am always up for a good sermon on a Hebrew scripture text, especially since this one opens with folks I seem to know well, the rabble among them.
So I've always liked that line. If only we had more meat to eat. My God. So you recall the story, and putting the story in context, the first complaint is we have no food. The second complaint is we don't like this food.
Right.
Anyone who has raised children knows this story. There's not, how many of us have had a teenager open the refrigerator, stare at a refrigerator so full you can't put anything else in it, and they say,
There's nothing around here to eat.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing here to eat. So it's that kind of complaint. I think it's Viktor Frankl, in one of his books, tells a story about a post World War II refugee camp, in which this huge room, probably an armory, everybody was on cots and everybody's trying to sleep. And this one woman was going, I am so thirsty. I am so thirsty. Every over and over. Finally, someone brought her some water and she drank, and it was quiet for about 15 minutes, people trying to get to sleep. And suddenly she started crying again. I was so thirsty. I was so thirsty.
Yeah.
And Frankl makes the point, the issue is not her thirst. The issue was her internal need to be loved. In some ways, some of what the rabble with the strong craving or weeping about again, the Israelites begin to weep again, is their dislocation. Sometimes we express our emotional and internal and spiritual hunger through complaints about physical needs that aren't getting met. I love this. Oh, remember the fish we used to eat in Egypt for nothing? The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. And I think of my sister when she moved out west, and you'd call her, and then she would start talking about fried chicken. Or, you know, traditional Southern foods. And it wasn't that she had nothing to eat. And it wasn't that those particular foods were what she needed. What she needed, she was dislocated.
Right.
So one of the things is just the unhappiness with where they are. And God has provided, but they are still unhappy.
Yeah. And I just to throw in a quick comment, I am listening right now. Thanks to Audible, by the way. I don't see as well as I used to, and so I listen to more books now. Brené Brown, I know many of our listeners are probably familiar with Brené Brown and a lot of her research. And I'm listening to a lecture she gave out of one of her later works, Rising Strong. And she's been talking about rising strong as a spiritual practice. And in fact, just this morning before the show, I was listening. And what caught my ear was this idea that our emotions, right, all of these things that we feel, she says, we call them feelings for a reason, because we notice them. They begin to manifest in our physical self. Yeah. And that's kind of what we're talking about here, trying to give the Israelites a little credit. Sometimes we read stories like this, and it's easy for us, dislocated in time, to say, well, why didn't they know better? Why didn't they know God was with them? Why didn't they, you know? Look, it's not all mental here, folks. This is an emotional response. I think you do well to point out they're displaced. They're dislocated. Yeah. And so you start paying attention to the physical stuff that's going around you. And that becomes a doorway in. So just sorry about that. Popped in my mind. Anybody wants to check out?
Just very recently, there was a situation that just reminded me of that. And it was a funeral at a church, big reception. And it was a long-term beloved member and who had passed, and a big crowd and a nice reception, lots of food. But a dispute between two other longtime members in the kitchen over the reception sort of spilled out for a little bit. And then that piece was later made. And people brought that up. And I pointed out, well, you know, grief takes all kinds of forms.
Absolutely.
You know, they tried to be, everybody was, you know, doing the nice thing. And then at some point, all those feelings erupted into, kind of bad behavior. And this is what's happening somewhat with the Israelites. It's just erupting into some bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And Moses joins right in with bad behavior. So that's one section. This whole standard same old song, we're just not happy and things aren't good and there's nothing but this manna to look at. Notice they say they look at it. Yeah. They didn't say nothing about it. It's like the kid at the plate. I don't want that. I have that all the time. I don't like that. Sit there and stare at their food and complain. Now, it says Moses heard the people all at the entrances of their tents. And he became angry, and Moses was displeased. I used to joke that when somebody came into my office as a pastor and started talking about how bad things were in their life, if my immediate response was internally, I never said this, was to think, you think you got troubles? Let me.
Yeah.
If I had no empathy, I knew it was time for me to go up on the mountain and have a little talk with God. I needed a break as pastor. Well, Moses needs a break. This is pretty obvious. You know, instead of, okay, people, he's caring for him. He's just overwhelmed. Might say Moses suffered 10 through 15 here. Let's see, where am I? Yeah. Verses 10 through 15. Moses is having a little bit of burnout. He said, I've done, and he explodes with his burnout. This whole thing is the Israelites are reacting emotionally to a difficult situation, and Moses is reacting to too much pressure on him. And why me, Lord? What did I ever do?
Yeah.
One of the images in here that's interesting is this whole in verse 12, where both the image for God, for Yahweh, and for Moses is female. You've got God as the birthing mother and Moses as the wet nurse. I don't know what you want to do with that, but it's just very interesting, the fluidity of imagery that they were comfortable with that we're sometimes not. You know, he used an illustration, and the writer did, of what Moses was feeling. That's basically puts them both in a feminine mode. God, I didn't birth this child.
Yeah.
You want me to wet nurse it. You know, and that's a vivid image for what's going on. It's just like, you wanted the baby, but you didn't want the trouble that goes with the baby, Lord. That's what he's accusing him of.
You done shucked him off on me.
Where, and then he said, well, am I going to get meat for all these people? How am I going to, they come in complaining and all this stuff, and that I'm just one man. If you, let's just do it. Just kill me.
It's amazing the number of times we see biblical characters sort of getting to that point. I mean, I immediately flash later to the scenes of Elijah. We have the scene with Jonah. You know, Lord, I'm just ready to be done. Just take me out of here. I've had enough of this.
Yep,
and the side note here, and I'd be careful about letting this creep into the sermon, but the side note for more than one of us as pastors is going, yeah, Moses, I know how you feel. I've had a lot of Mondays like that. I've had a lot of, you know, left a lot of board meetings and deacons meetings and, you know, congregational meetings and one thing and another. And you just go, what the is going on here?
It's just too much for him.
Yeah.
It's just become too much. And be careful in preaching, because if you stand up and preach and talk about how pastors feel, they're just going to be looking at you saying, uh-oh. Because they're just not going to hear it very well at this
point. That's it.
That section is more be a sermon for preachers, from preacher to preacher.
Use this for your own work. However,
however,
continues. Yeah.
In the context, it is sometimes the leadership of any group can become too much. And so there's that whole thing of it's okay to complain to God and to express what's going on. I remember one parishioner at a church I left, and he'd been a Christian for many, many years, and he'd come to us from a different tradition. And his parting words to me, he says, told me it was okay for me to feel the way I felt sometimes with God and to tell God about it. That's what's going on here. It's okay. This is a very important message for people to hear. And then you have the God, you know, I always love the good news in here. So the Lord said, that's the one of that. There's the turn on 16.
Yeah. And it doesn't begin by, and so the Lord said, suck it up, Moses.
No,
you know,
no.
It didn't say, I'm tired of your bitching and complaining. You don't get any of that. God speaks, and there's action. God acts.
It's almost, okay, you're right. You know, now the Lord fixes it. Now, this is an interesting turn sociologically, is these are people who had been in a system in which there was a Pharaoh, and the Pharaohs could do whatever he wanted to do, and it was very hierarchical, and they came out, and Moses becomes the leader, and everything he says goes, and all this stuff. And this is an interesting story in terms of the development of Israel with the 12 the tribes and the leadership and the dispersal and the early days in which they did the judges and the clans and the gathering, what it meant to be Israel with prophet and this, that, and the other. And remember, when they wanted a king, the prophet said, you probably don't want that.
Yeah.
This is an early story about saying one person can't run this show.
Yeah.
Can't meet all the needs. And that's this whole 16 through 25 is a fascinating story, but most of it has to do the 16 and then 24. This has to do about bringing the 70 from the community. And what I'm fascinated about is it's, and you know, however you view the bestowal of the Spirit, it didn't say, and then he put more Spirit on them. It said, took some of the Spirit that Moses had and redistributed it on the others. And that's a symbol of the same, there's this one bit of God's authority in the congregation, or God's power, or God's prophecy, and it is redistributed, if I can use that term. It's taken out rather than so it's the Lord working with the community, and yeah. it they gather in a tent, and it's a redistribution. They begin to prophesy. I love the line, but only once. Prophecy wasn't as important as service. And this was the deal, was to part of the complaint situation was Moses was trying to do too much and people's needs weren't getting met, and let these people make some of the decisions. So that's a whole wonderful section there, 16 and 24, 25,
yeah.
And it's a part of their development as a people, as they're beginning to figure out what it means to be a community. And some preaching lessons can be, how do we learn to be community? How do we do decision-making, and how do we work together as a community?
I think it's pretty interesting to note as well. Of course, I'm always looking through to the theological concerns and what do we learn here. You mentioned that the Spirit is redistributed here, but I think it's important to note, and yet it is not diminished.
It's not diminished.
Right? The Spirit is not diminished. And so theologically here, the Spirit of the Lord is still present. The Spirit of the Lord is upon the people. The Spirit of the Lord is at work. It's not a zero-sum game. Well, we only have so much to go around, so y'all are going to get a lesser version of the Spirit, and Moses is somehow not going to be as effective and as important now because God had to take some. No, everybody receives the evidently the full measure of the Spirit.
Exactly, and God has more than enough Spirit to go around.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So then the last section, 26 through 29, is the story about Eldad and Medad. And one of the fascinating things is they were among those registered, but they didn't go. They got picked, but for whatever reason, they didn't go. It reminds me of stories like Jonah. You know, Jonah's like the Lord. They've gotten picked. Jonah got picked. He got on a boat and he ran. And God didn't let him get away, and he didn't let Eldad and Medad get away from what they had been selected for. They stayed, so he just, Lord just put the Spirit on them there in the camp, and they went to prophesy. So sometimes the emphasis in talking about this part of the text is on those of us inside the tent, and what kind of fingers are we going to point at people outside the tent, and that's good. You know, well, they're not in the tent. You know, Joshua gets excited. They weren't here. Stop them. And what Moses said, would that all God's people got the Spirit, you know, got the Spirit. But another piece here that you need to focus on is that those who are reluctant, that if God, you know, if God has chosen you, eventually that God's hand is going to be on you.
Yeah.
You know, they couldn't resist, and it was going to happen. You can run, but you can't hide. But there's this dynamic here. I think also the traditional one is very important, is that we have a tendency toward us and them. And, you know, it's interesting. So there's everybody, there's God, and there's Moses, and there's everybody else. And then you have this incident where 70 are picked and come into the tent, and they get the Spirit. Only 68 of them are the only ones that showed up. And immediately Joshua gets with an us and them. Well, they're not in the tent. They don't get to have the Spirit. It's amazing how quickly we draw lines. And Moses' response, are you jealous for my sake?
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about me. I wish everybody were.
Yeah.
So, and that's my transition to the gospel lesson. You know, in which Jesus says essentially the same thing about this situation like this. Moving to Mark 9, 38 through 50, the first three verses are pretty easy to deal with. You know, you've got a situation where John says, like Joshua, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name. We tried to stop them because he was not following us." Someone. He said, "Don't stop him."
Yeah.
And it's the same as "don't stop Eldad and me, Dad. Whoever is not against us is for us." I want to point out one very important thing with that text. It didn't say, "Teacher, we saw someone trying to cast out demons."
Mm-hmm.
In your name.
Mm-hmm.
He was casting out demons.
Yeah. Eldad and me, Dad, were prophesying.
Yeah.
It wasn't, they tried to prophesy. They weren't mocking anybody. They weren't trying to cash in on the moment. They were prophesying. Here you got people casting out demons in the name of Jesus. Yeah.
Jesus, those are not against us. They're for us. So that sort of works at the end of the Numbers text and the first part of the gospel text. You can put those two together. Whichever one you want to talk about first in a sermon. And that's a good sermon of talking about within your community or your faith tradition, ecumenicity, and how do we look at what others are doing and how do we respond to them. And, you know, there's the whole question of, well, they don't do communion right. from the liturgical traditions, we could stand around and say, "Well, you know, you wouldn't believe what kind of worship they do. Is the Lord active in what they're doing?"
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, well, you know, they're not very spiritual at that church. You know, it's just so dry, formal. You know, I wish they would get, you know, they need to get the spirit and dance a little bit and get excited. Is God active in what they are doing? Whose tent are they in?
Yeah, we draw many lines. We make many judgments, and I think the tent is a great image here. They're outside our tent. Can we trust anything they're doing? Well, there comes a point where you say, "Well, at what point does this appear to be the work of God? At what point, you know?" And besides, what control do we really have over that? Over how they are going to express their ministry, their work for God. I warned you about this, Bubba, and I honestly do not want to chase anything here.
All right.
But I will confess that this gospel text for today, as well as its connection to the Numbers text, has really raised in me the need to think about a lot of the current lines of discussion I hear going on in American culture and society, and especially in terms of leadership. And at what point do I say, "Boy, I really don't agree with that leader. I really don't agree with lifestyle. I really don't agree with their choices. There's an awful lot I don't agree with them." And yet at what point do I have to say, "But they're just doing their job," or I need to, you know, let them do their job. There's a lot of justification for everything from president down to, in the old day, we'd say local dog catcher going around. "Well, yeah, I don't agree with everything that person's done, but they've got a job to do, and I think we need to let them do it." And so I'm still admitting my struggle right now. Where does it come in my speaking up? What is outside the bounds? What is merely outside the tent? What is merely someone working in a way that I may not be comfortable with? And where does my, you know, where do I fall on that? So, again, I'm not sure you want to throw that in as a sermon point from your pulpit this week.
Well, it is an and the rest of Mark's gospel talks about morality and what is the moral questions here. And the question does arise, at what point does the trains running on time cease to be justification for other things that are happening? I mean, that's basic question. How, at what point do you say, okay, yeah, every efficiency is being achieved, but at what cost? At what point does a Christian have to say, this is not a cost we can live with? You know, that's a good question. Yeah. And everybody has to come to that answer. As one of the things Fred Craddock had to say about this text was, in his commentary on it, was, what is the internal unity? Preacher's going to have to deal with 9:38 through 50 in Mark with the question of internal unity. What holds this together? And his response is that it's all around the whole text is around the question of, what does it mean to be a disciple? What does discipleship mean? The audience for this is for someone who has committed themselves to deny self, take up a cross, and follow. Mm-hmm. This is who he's talking to. This is what Mark's trying to get at in this thing. And so then we find it falling out in four kind of sections. You have 38 through 40, which we just talked about who's in and who's out. And that, because there's the 12, and then there are the 70 that he sent out two by two, and then there are those people that just follow along. And the question is, well, who's included in these Jesus people, and what's the measure of being included? And Jesus says, whoever is not against us is for us. That's pretty loose, you know. And if he's doing a deed in my power, will not soon be able to speak against me. In other words, let the Spirit blow. So there's one question, who's in, who's out. Hospitality is, again, you know, the cup of water in the, you bear the name of Christ. It's pretty low and pretty loose. If you do random deeds of kindness, that's in God's name. Okay, there you go. The little ones, we often think of that in terms of children. It's partly because it's tied to last week's gospel lesson about a little child and all of that. But little ones in this context has to do with new converts and new members of the church and people who have just become a part of the faith community. And in Craddock's opinion, this is addressed to the early church. And it's trying to say, don't go around judging people because they hadn't been in the church as long as you have and don't know that the bathroom is down to the right, not down to the left. And that, I remember one of my mentors in ministry talked about his work with evangelism and new member stuff. And he said, some churches, as quick as the pastor can bring them in the front door, the old line members knock them in the head and throw them out the back.
Yeah.
That not letting little ones to stumble is being aware that as people become new, don't let the little ones stumble.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing, and I haven't been avoiding, if your hand causes you to stumble, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. But
talking about disciples must be morally earnest, might be the way to put it. This is hyperbole for the sake of emphasis. So he's not actually literally wanting you to cut off hands and feet and other things. Right. But he is saying something you think is very important to you, if it's getting in the way of your denying yourself, taking up the cross, it's better to remove that.
You better think about giving that up, brother.
Better giving that up. And there's not a, if that's getting in the way of your following Christ, then you better think about giving it up.
Yeah.
Well, brother.
Well, good stuff. We didn't touch much on James, but, you know, there's James, I think, offers a good connection today to sort of what I see as a common theme here, and that is we're humans and we're frail. We don't do things perfectly. And, you know, we mentioned Elijah earlier. Elijah comes back in here. James talking about the power of prayer, talking about this need to get close to God, says, hey, Elijah, man, he was just like us. And he ended up in the fetal position crying under a bush saying, Lord, kill me. I can't handle it anymore.
Well, one this, person.
Yeah. And this guy prays and look what happens, you know. So.
So it's basically, this is a community life lesson.
Yeah.
You know, who, what do? You know, and it's all congregational life as we know it, suffering, happy, sick, sinful, confessing, praying, healing, wandering, doubting, returning to the faith. This is ongoing life. And that's all bathed in prayer and praise.
And it's all
forgiveness and caring for each other.
It is. It is part of the community. It is part of this wonderful, beautiful, common life that we share. Well, we do believe that these words are life and that they give life. And some weeks requires a little more wrestling and thinking than others. But we pray y'all's wrestling will go well this week, and that we have not confused the issue, but maybe opened up a couple of things for everybody to think about.
So this is one of those days I fervently pray the verse 14 of Psalm 19. Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable to you, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer.
Which makes
we have wandered about, but we ask the Lord to bless it and help you.
Which also reminds me of good advice you gave me one week, Bubba, when I back in the days when we shared a building up there in Nashville, Brookhalla Baptist and the Holy Trinity Lutheran, and we'd have a Monday morning session or two, and I came in one week and I said, boy, it wasn't much good yesterday. And you said, what? And I said, well, my sermon. I just couldn't get it going. And he said, well, Brother John, these are the days that, like our physician friends, we need to remember the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. So y'all keep that in mind this week if you need to.
Do no harm.
Not much left for us to do, Bubba, other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Lock and Key by Silent Partner. We go out this session with three Winans brothers, B.B., Marvin, and Carvin, singing If God Be For Us.
Those predestinate, He also called, and to whom He called, He justified, and to whom He justified, He glorified. So what do we say to all these things? If God be for us, then who can be then who can be against us? If God be for me, then who can be against me?
In spite of my failure, I've still been called, and because of Calvary, I've been justified, and when it's all over, He promised to glorify. So what do we say to all of these things? This is what we say.
God before us, who can be against us?
Say of God,
God before us, who can be against us?
Say of God,
God before me, who can be
try.